know Van Dick, so you got to bear with me a little bit. When you're trying to just describe what I would remember, see, I'm an analog guy. My test instruments, like you say, antique is, but you say they're okay. When you're trying to describe something called a reaction modulator a few minutes ago, am I on the right track? Over.
Yeah, up till now, Mel, your signal was dead full quieting into the repeater. You're now, we heard everything you said, but you're quite a bit noisier. And I heard the amplitude going into the repeater jumping up and down, as if you've got a loose RF connector on the back end of that transmitter. Yes, the early phase modulators were a so-called reactance modulator. And properly designed, they were very linear across their designed phase modulating region. But you try to ask it to go much bigger in phase modulation. And that's what happens with a phase transmitter being used in an FM environment, and you're trying to feed through 88 hertz, and it wasn't designed to go below 300 hertz. And you're taking that 88 hertz and integrating it to try to convert the whole system into an FM, and now you're making a whopping big signal at 88, and that particular integrator is probably saturating, and I guarantee that that reactance modulator is also saturating. It wasn't designed to go that wide. And the difference between phase and frequency, not easy to understand, but you've got the tip of the iceberg there, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, all of a sudden, you know, the repeater drops in power or something, Dick, because I checked it on the other receiver. Same thing. I had a dip all of a sudden in the power level coming from the receiver. From your
Well, the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club.
Let's get back to amateur radio. Why did I remember? Link active. The FCC said that they would only permit narrow band FM or so-called PM on any on the frequencies below 30 megahertz. So, referring it to amateur radio, yeah, what was really the whole story about that? That's why we went there. That NBFM and all came into vogue below 30 megahertz. Over.
For a whole lot of years, I remember the FCC requirement was that FM was allowed in certain ham bands if the total transmitted signal did not occupy more than the normal bandwidth of another kind of ham radio signal. I mean, if that band allowed you to use AM, and if the AM used audio up to 3.5 kilohertz, which means that the total AM signal would be 3.5 times 2 or 7 kilohertz wide, as long as you can take your FM signal and keep it within 7 kilohertz of total bandwidth, you're inside of the FCC requirements. So when you do that, it's called narrowband FM. If my audio signal I'm transmitting is a 1 kilohertz note, and I'm only transmitting plus and minus 3 kilohertz, that is a modulation index that is less than pi, and less than pi of modulation index is usually called narrowband FM. So we got some funny definitions. There's no clear definition of where is 100% modulation with FM. It's a matter of how well you've designed the modulator and how well you've designed the receiver, and are you willing to tolerate a signal that wide. So the FCC forced you into no greater bandwidth, and if you're willing to do that, and you and I call it narrowband FM, then in many of those ham bands it's allowed. K2KEY, K2RIW.
So in other words, they insisted that we call it narrowband FM. In other words, narrowband FM was the criteria was that it should not occupy any more space, I guess, than an AM signal, I assume. You know, I don't remember. For a while, narrowband FM seemed to be coming in, and then it disappeared. I was really wondering, what was the real story on it? I guess it's just because, like you say, it had the constraints of, in other words, not being any more, taking up any more territory than an AM signal. Is that correct? Over.
Yeah, there's some pluses and minuses as to the advantages of FM on a ham band. On the 6 meter ham band for a whole lot of years, starting around 1962 or so, up to 1965, I guess it was, I ran on 6 meters a narrowband FM transmitter, all solid state, of my own design, with a 1-2 final. It was a 300-watt transmitter on 6 meters with a 4CX250B final. And the nice thing about FM is I could modulate a 300-watt transmitter with 1 milliwatt of audio way back at the first oscillator, way upstream. Ordinarily, a 300-watt AM transmitter would require 150 watts of audio. And I wasn't willing to build that. I was lazy. And I would have to tell each guy I talked to, yeah, you can hear my carrier, and if you want to hear my audio, you got to tune off to one side, slope detect it. And most of the guys can do it, but you take a guy with a real good, let me drop. You take a guy with a real good, well-designed single sideband receiver, where the filter in there was a brick wall filter with 1.9 or 2.2 kilohertz of bandwidth and real steep slides to that filter. And if he tried slope detecting my FM signal, it was plus or minus, let's say, 3 kc, he could hear the audio, but he got a very distorted version of it. So the better receivers got less and less good audio out of it. Also, if the signal is truly narrowband, which is probably plus or minus 1.5 or 2 kc of FM deviation, believe it or not, the mathematics will allow you to properly set the center frequency of the receiver right on the carrier. You zero beat that carrier and listen to it in the pure single sideband mode, and you do get perfect audio out of it if the signal is narrowband enough. Very narrowband FM is double sideband, single sideband. It's two sidebands. The upper sideband and the lower sideband will sound nearly perfect into a good single sideband receiver as long as you keep it truly narrowband. I wonder if you've ever heard about that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2LAW.
And now it comes back to me. Now I remember what the whole hullabaloo was all about. Yes, yes, yes. What happened was the with FM, a narrowband FM, the problem was that situation of receiving it, it was not as effective. That was the word. I remember now, Helicraft, I remember saying that they were squelching it because they didn't want to, you know, because their receivers they were producing had questions about, you know, the stability and everything. And they that was that they came up with that station, that narrowband FM or is not as effective as AM with the methods of reception used by most amateurs, Dick, over.
Yeah, with the communication course that I took at Pratt Institute in my senior year, I did write a final report for my communication course on the comparison of FM versus sideband versus AM. Which has the best threshold, which has the best fidelity, and so on. And because of the capture effect, as long as the carrier is strong enough, as long as you got a good, let me pick a number, 8 or more dB of carrier to noise ratio, then FM will give you cleaner sounding audio than either of the other two. However, that capture effect of the limiter discriminator works against you when the signal gets weak. When the signal in a FM system gets weak, the receiver and the discriminator starts getting captured by noise pulses, and the noise dominates, and the discriminator now starts suppressing your weak signal. That's why the unified S-band signal for NASA has to use threshold extension techniques when something goes wrong and the signal gets weak, as it did on the Mercury mission, because they hadn't yet discovered multi-factor effect of the antenna. We'll go into that later. So the signal was 15 dB weaker than they expected it to be, and it was really at the noise level, so to speak, and you almost didn't hear the astronauts. on the early Mercury missions because of that problem. FM has got a lot of misunderstanding, as you can tell. It's quite different than what people expect, but once you understand a little bit more of it, you can now design better systems, phase lock loop frequency discriminator systems. You have a little bit more understanding why your particular taxi cab rig, let me drop. Almost all of the early Motorola taxi cab rigs really use the crystal controlled oscillator, reactance modulator, phase modulator technique for creating the FM, which you could call it the Armstrong technique. That was originally done by Armstrong in 1935. And then Hund in his 1943 book gave you a lot more mathematics and schematic diagrams and whatever as to how to do it, as FM broadcasts were starting to really catch on. And I guess they wanted more people to be designing client receivers, in other words, home receivers for listening to FM broadcast over the air. And then because of a whole bunch of arguments between him and RCA and Armstrong, Asanov, they got moves from the 48 meg region up to the 100 meg region. And I guess Sarnoff thought that was going to kill him. In reality, it worked out very well. Let me think now. Does anybody have any questions on what they've heard so far? I know this took longer than we expected. However, I think it's a good educational process. You now know. Let me turn it over to John. I think you see now, John, why the signal before going into the discriminator, an FM modulated signal, is very complicated. To look at it there, for most applications, only has academic interest. But if you really want to make quantitative measurements of the kind you and I and Glenn have been talking about, it's got to be at the discriminator output, not in the IF strip, if you know what I mean. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Question.
John first, and then over to Mel, Wesley. John, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, I heartily agree with you, and it would be the easiest way to go, I believe, for me. I have started to mount the search for that schematic diagram for my 7100. So that's the way I will be going. And as soon as I can, I will be talking to you about that. But I think it's going to be an adventure. I really do, and it's going to be very interesting. And thank you for all this information. It's really helpful.
By the way, do you intend to use your dynamic signal analyzer looking at the signal coming out of a seismic detector? Go ahead.
Yes, I want to do that also. The only thing I've noticed, the acquisition time of signal doesn't seem to be enough time to be able to register it on the screen in my simple test that I've been doing so far. But I've been there.
Yeah, I can see the problem. When a dynamic signal analyzer is analyzing a signal, it makes the assumption that the signal is continuously there and unchanging. It is not the right instrument to catch a dynamic event, a one-time event. Although I guess you could force it to do that by using the right kind of a recording device and making a loop out of that recorder. But that's, again, getting into the academic area of what frequency components are present in the seismic event. It's going to have to be a looping recorder. It is not the right machine to catch a transient event. It is the right machine to catch what you and I have been talking about. N2XJM, K2LIW, go ahead, Wesley.
I have a few questions. The subject that we discussed before. And I was thinking about double slit experiment, and I am kind of confused with in this area, as the particles could behave as waves, but at the same time, when you observe them, they don't create the interference pattern. So at that point, it's like they scare about somebody looking at them. So, are they wave, and what kind of wave? Are there particles? Now, if they are the wave, they are photons. And another question is, when the photon from the sun reacts with an electron from the air particles, then it creates another photon. But in the temporary stage, that electron is distorted. Now, another question. When during the electron flow, atom is losing the electron, let me jump. Atom is losing the electron, then the atom is distorted. Dmitry Ivanovich Mendeleev, in 1834, there was a Russian chemist and investor. He created the tablet of all of the substances, and he predicted the properties. So it does have to have a
2 meter transmit.
We know that if we create HHO out of H2O, then actually we're doing the changes into the atomic structure. In other words, we remove the bonding between two atoms of between hydrogen and oxygen. Anyhow, the nature of my question in everything that I said so far is that it's a big one confusion. Starting from the double slip experiment, due to the moment of explanation how the current flow or how the photon is changed to something that has a mass, but that has a mass creates photon as well because of reflection and refraction. And also, in double slit experiment, you cannot put the electron into the one of the slits. And it's just that it does not allow you to do it. But if you do it and then you observe that you did it, then it behaves like it's a marble. Other than that, it creates the interference pattern. So I would like you to just catch what I was trying to say, or maybe I can ask John to explain it better. Deep quick pickup.
B2HWW, please.
Howie, do you have a brief question or on this particular subject, or are you changing subjects? Over to you, Howie.
To your past comment about narrowband FM, I just wanted to ask you one simple question. Quickly, any particular reason why on the aircraft band they took AM instead of FM? I think I know the answer. If you can answer that.
I am guessing that they know that pilots would occasionally be talking on top of each other. In the case of an AM transmitter where both of them are on the exact same frequency and they're not giving a beat note because they're not offset in frequency, you do hear both voices at the same time. And so the weaker guy who is hollering Mayday, you stand a chance of hearing him in AM. In the case of FM, the strong guy captures the limiter, the weak guy gets eliminated, and you hear the weak guy hollering Mayday. That's a guess on my part. How back to you, Harry.
Well, I think also, do you think it has to do with the fact that AM has a less effect to multipath, and also that, as you said previously, that an FM signal has to be really strong, you know, full quality, basically, to be well heard, and an AM signal can be a lot weaker. You still hear it. It may not sound pretty, but you hear it farther into the noise than you will in FM. And did I hear you say that it is better mathematically to look at it at the discriminator instead of the IF? Is that what you said?
I sure did. If you want to analyze the nature of the FM modulated signal and you want to pick out individual audio components before it was FM modulated, then looking at the discriminator is 100 times easier than looking at the signal before the discriminator. Before the discriminator, very difficult to figure out what's going on. But yes, an AM signal can tolerate weaker signals and you can get audio out of it. and it can tolerate multiple signals talking under on top of each other. But when it comes to multipath effects, is AM better surviving at multipath than FM? That's a questionable one, and there are lots of people arguing over that one. But now let's get back to Wesley's original question. Let me drop.
In other words, I want to know if we're dealing with matter as a wave, or we're dealing with the matter as something that has a mass. That's the first question. The second question is, if we take out the element of the atom, that this atom is no longer the atom of the substance, in temporary stage is a quite different structure, according to Mendeleev.
Dick, Wesley sent you an email. I don't know if you had time to read that, but this is what he's referring to.
Yeah, very fine, John. I haven't seen his email yet. I was doing something right up till the TechNet began. The sun is definitely creating ionization when the stuff coming out of the sun hits our upper atmosphere. It definitely creates the ionosphere, the aurora borealis, and whatever. I've been told that the majority of the ionosphere is created by the ultraviolet radiation coming out of the sun. Now, when you want to excite molecules to a higher state, in other words, you want the electrons around the nucleus to go to a higher excited state and or really create a plasma, in other words, to completely separate the electrons from the nucleus, you have to do it with just the right magnitude of wavelength of energy, and ultraviolet does that. I think you're also getting a small amount of the ionosphere created by impact ionization. The solar wind is giving you individual particles moving at a million miles an hour approximately, sometimes faster. And when they impact the atmosphere, I think they're the major causative agent for the aurora borealis, and that aurora is another kind of plasma, obvious by the fact it does a beautiful job of reflecting radio waves. I have done aurora reflection on 432. It takes a lot of antenna gain and a lot of transmit power to do it, but that aurora borealis will do a beautiful job of reflecting a 432 signal. It doesn't reflect it as well as lower frequency. So the majority of the ionization of the ionosphere is ultraviolet first and impact ionization from solar wind second. Now, in the case of the dual slit experiment, let me drop. To my knowledge, that is done by sending individual photons at the dual slit, and the screen beyond the dual slit where you start integrating a picture, you end up with an interferometry pattern when you do it with photons, and those photons in that experiment are acting like a wave. If I shot electrons at the dual slit, I don't think I get an interferometry pattern, but there I'm not sure.
Yes, you do. The thing is, the problem is that when you send it, it does not go through even one single leg. It does not go to one slit only, but it creates the interferometry pattern as if it was the wave. Now, when you watch it, just watch it, and you take the device, then this will behave like a marble just because you're watching at it. Now, if you don't watch at it, you didn't change anything. You just remove the device that was watching for that electron. It creates a pattern. So the question then is, whether this is wave or this is the matter. If this is the matter, then we're dealing with mass. If it's a wave, we're dealing with photons. What is the matter?
Yeah, I'm way out of my area on this one.
Well, Louis de Broglie, Broglie, in 1923, he made this experiment. And also, number of scientists, PhDs, were experimenting on it. One of them, in the video that I have sent, was almost denied to become a PhD just because of the fact that he was standing at that experiment, which was actually confirmed. It's no doubt about it. It is behaving this way, but you.
Yeah, when I hear these stories about an experiment that if you watch it, you get one result, and if you don't watch it, you get another result. I've heard those stories. I don't have a good explanation for that. I'm troubled by that. I don't understand that one.
Okay, so the other one. I sent you the three sets of videos. One is the professor from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And in the first few minutes, he states that a photon, when it hits the particles of air, it hits electron, and this electron creates a photon back. Now, what is happening with this electron?
From most of the wavelengths of optical light that I'm familiar with, those kind of photons, to me the atmosphere is 99.9% transparent. So for the optical wavelengths, there's just a very slight amount of scattering that takes place at the ultraviolet end of the spectrum. That's why the sky looks blue. But the majority of the optical photons go right through the atmosphere, to my knowledge, with no interaction.
Well, see, what's happening is when the sun is low, when it's sunset and sunrise, then we see the red sun because the polarization is horizontal. And that photon has a lot of air to go through. Now, this professor has made, and I have sent you also the separate link for whatever is going on with the light and refraction, the reflection, and polarization. My question is, what is happening with the substance when it loses electron in temporary stage? With HHO, we have no longer dealing with water because we already destructed the atomic structure based on Mendeleev. So now we don't have a water, we have two gases. How come the air doesn't get split?
I've read that the sunset red sky is not due to polarization, it's due to filtering. You're looking through a much longer path of air at sunset, obvious by the fact that the air scatters blue light better than red light. That's the reason why at high sky is blue, because you're looking at the scattering of blue. And as you go to sunset, and you're now looking through 10 times as much atmosphere at a slant angle, and the blue is being filtered out, and what's left over is red. That is a low-pass filter characteristic. I'm not convinced that the red sunset has any particular polarization to it. That's not a polarization effect. I think that's a pure bandpass filter effect.
No. 1934, I forgot the name of the inventor, he invented the piece of material that when you rotate that material, you actually created a polarization. That's what the professor from Massachusetts used in his video. He explained all of the phenomena, but I came to the conclusion that there are more questions that I have after watching that video than the answers. Back to you.
In the early days, 20 years ago, when I was doing a lot of photography, I own a polarizing filter, a Series 7 polarizing filter that I can put in front of my telephoto lens. And when I did that at certain angles at high solar, in other words, near high noon, at certain angles of the picture, when I used the polarizer, I could make the blue sky turn much, much darker, so that at certain angles, the signal coming off the blue sky is polarized. I'm going to give you that. But I don't think there's any polarization left at the red sky. I vaguely remember using that polarizing filter at sunset and not seeing any change. So I'm not convinced that a sunset is polarized. The red sunset, I don't think, is polarized. Wesley, back to you on that one. Go ahead.
Well, the polarization is very much snapped into the scattering. And the professor actually used a cigarette on the classroom. He says he hates this kind of experimentation, to show that at this, at the different angle of light, you are able to achieve different color. But the students were using polarizers. So each one was giving the polarizer. But my question is, again, what is happening to the structure that is distorted in temporary stage? Based on this video that I saw, the photon hits the electron of the air, and then molecular structure is distorted. That electron is actually creating another photon. That's the scattering. So my question, that's what I gave you then with the HHO. Back to you.
Okay, I'm suddenly seeing a relationship between the cloud scatter communication I did on 10 gigahertz ham radio and the darkening sky effect that I did with my polarizing filter during optical photography. When the sun angle on the sky you're looking through is at right angles, let's assume now that the sun is coming from the south and I've got my camera aimed toward the east. In other words, the parcel of air I'm looking at the illuminated air by the sun at right angles. When I do that, the polarization I get out of that air is strongly vertically polarized. There's almost no horizontal component left, and I can explain that. Very similar to what happened with 10 gigahertz cloud bounce communication. When the cloud you're transmitting to, in order to reflect the signal on 10 gigahertz, is at right angles to you, all horizontal polarization disappears and only vertical polarization is left. And I can explain that one. So there has to be a right angle phenomena with sky and polarization. Sunset doesn't fulfill that. I guess I could look at the sunset at a sunset period. I could look at the sky 90 degrees away from the sunset and maybe I would see some polarization. I'm going to give you that. But if I'm taking a picture of the sunset itself, I'm looking directly down the barrel of the sun, and I think there is no polarization in that one. And do you know why at right angles there is polarization? K2RIW and 2XJN, go ahead.
Awesome.
There was somebody with a question.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
In optical photography, if there was polarization of the sun as it was setting, if you rotated the polarization lens, you would notice a difference in the amplitude, the luminosity.
Exactly. And I don't remember taking a picture of a sunset with a polarizing filter and seeing any difference. If I aim the camera 90 degrees away from the sun and I operate the polarizer, yes, I would see an effect. And should that be explained, John? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, I think there you're 100% correct, because I did a lot of that photography and I did not notice that effect. Same as you. Did I go 90 degrees? No, and if I did, I don't realize the difference, but I definitely did it into the sun. And if there was polarization, as you know how they work, if you had two polarized lens, you put them up 90 degrees opposing, you'll have darkness.
Yeah, no matter what the nature of the original illumination is, if you've got two polarizing filters at right angles, you'll kill everything coming through. It's a band stop. But when you're using a single polarizer, piece of Polaroid material, and you're looking at a chunk of air, sky, at right angles to the sun illumination of that sky, you get a very strong vertical polarization effect. Also, when it comes to reflection off of glass or reflection off of water, there's a strong polarization effect that, again, can be explained. Oh, that one's more into Brewster angle phenomena, whereas the sky is more a what's called the Onkin extinction theory. Every one of those air molecules that looks blue when you're looking at a blue sky, it really is excitation and re-radiation. When the illumination from the sun is at right angles, the excitation portion that is horizontally polarized from the sun after re-radiation is in the exact same plane of the signal coming toward you. And all electromagnetic radiation that radiates must be transverse. Let me drop. Now let me draw this diagram a little bit more clearly. Assume the sun is in the south, and it's illuminating a chunk of sky that's in front of me when my camera is aimed to the east. Some of the illumination from the sun is exciting those air molecules with vertical polarization. The vertical polarization re-radiated by those air molecules is able to come toward me because that vertical polarization is transverse. It's opposite. It's at right angle. The polarization is at right angles to the path of propagation. That's TEM, transverse electromagnetic. The horizontal polarization that is coming out of the sun when it excites those air molecules, some of that air molecule is shaking toward me or away from me. That's what the horizontal polarization from the sun is doing. That polarization of signal coming toward me cannot propagate. You can only propagate an electromagnetic wave when there is a component transverse to the direction of propagation. The component that's toward me and away from me is not transverse, and I don't see it. Therefore, with my polarizing filter at that right angle environment I just described, I will see beautiful vertical polarized sky light. And when I adjust the filter to accept only horizontal, the sky turns dark. The blue sky turns almost black, and you get a huge contrast increase between the cloud, the white cloud, and the blue sky. I bet you've seen that effect, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Exactly, Dick. That's how they work, and I have noticed that. And that's why I said if the sun was setting and it was polarized, you would be able to almost zero it out with one single polarizing lens.
Now, when it comes to the individual very small air molecules behaving this way, I almost understand it. I'm now having trouble understanding why does the white cloud stay bright when I adjust the filter to reject vertical. When I adjust the filter for only accepting horizontal polarization of light, I'm having trouble understanding why does the white cloud stay white as opposed to getting darker. Maybe the cloud gets a little bit darker, but it does a lot slower than the air, the blueness of the air. I know that the contrast goes up sky high between blue sky and white cloud when you're using the polarizing filter in that manner. Got a guess as to why the cloud doesn't get dark, John? KQRIW?
My understanding and my simple thinking was that the horizontally polarized wave is coming at you, and when you're aligned in a horizontal mode, that will pass. As you go vertical, you will eliminate the horizontal and accent the vertical. That was my understanding, Dick.
I just thought of it. The air molecules are approximately an angstrom in diameter, a very small number of nanometers, or a fraction of a nanometer. The optical light I'm using is 550 nanometers, the center of my optical band. So the individual sky air molecules are a very small fraction of a wavelength. Therefore, they do what I think is called Rayleigh scattering. In other words, the scattering that they do preserves polarization. And because a certain portion of the incident light, which was horizontally polarized from the sun, is now shaking those air molecules toward me and away from me, the horizontal component, and I don't see it. Whereas the vertical component, which is going up and down from my point of view, I certainly see that. In the case of the aerosols of a cloud, those individual water droplets are many optical wavelengths in diameter. Now I'm getting specular scattering. In other words, a portion, if I had a round Christmas tree ball, a silvered round Christmas tree ball, which by definition, let me drop, definition is a very large number of wavelengths in diameter. The portion of that Christmas tree ball that falls at a 45-degree angle to me and a 45-degree angle from the sun is going to give me a beautiful specular reflection. I'm going to see a bright spot in that Christmas tree ball that looks like the sun. It's going to be a little bit off to one side of the center from my point of view. That's the place where the Christmas tree ball is at a 45-degree angle to me and the sun. Angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. Because the Christmas tree ball is many wavelengths in diameter, I get specular reflection. Because the aerosol water droplets in that cloud are very large compared to the optical wavelength, I'm getting specular reflection, therefore the white cloud still stays bright. It's not the Rayleigh scattering that I get off of the individual air molecules, which are much, much, much smaller. I think that's what's going on here, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Right, Dick, I think it's the emissivity of the target. I think you're right there. The atmosphere may have nothing to do with that.
Question. How would you picture shaking air molecules? So the photon from the sun is going to the air molecule. How do we picture that shaking?
In order for excitation and re-radiation to take place, and it does, and that is the explanation for why you get the Brewster angle cancellation when you get a reflection at certain angles off of a dielectric surface. If I've got water or plastic or whatever, various kinds of dielectric material that are giving me a reflected optical wave at certain angles called the Brewster angle, the reflection for certain polarizations disappears. So the individual molecules of the plastic or the individual molecules of the air are being excited and re-radiating, and they're re-radiating with the exact same polarization of the signal that excited them.
And here is the question, how they are being excited, what is being excited? Do we dealing with the energy loss? And exactly which part of that particle is being excited? How do you picture that excited?
When I read my book on optics called HECT, H-E-C-T, a very well written textbook, it calls it excitation and re-radiation. My simplistic diagram of an air molecule or a molecule of the plastic, as I say, it is shaking in that direction. And I think that's overly simplistic. What I think is really going on is the photon of energy with a particular polarization, and I'm guessing that each individual photon has one particular polarization, that in order to transmit a circular polarized optical wave, I'm transmitting a whole lot of photons of those various polarizations, is what I'm thinking. But
and here I have a problem, because based on the words of this professor that you have a video, he says the light from the sun and the light from the light bulb does not have a polarization at all. Proceed.
Oh, I accept that. I can take a light bulb, I can shine it like the sun coming from the south on a bunch of air molecules. It's thoroughly non-polarized, thoroughly non-coherent, and now I aim my camera at that air parcel. By aiming my camera to the east, I'm looking at the air molecules at right angle to their excitation. And that unpolarized light bulb, just like the sun, is primarily unpolarized. There's some horizontal polarization and some vertical components of the original light excitation. The vertical components that excite those air molecules and the air molecules re-radiate, I see the vertical component, and I can pass it through my polarizing filter. The horizontal component out of that light bulb hits those air molecules, and I do not see them. I adjust my polarizing filter to accept horizontal, and the sky goes dark. So this individual, all the polarizations in the world are coming out of that light bulb. I think almost all the polarizations that are possible are coming out of that sunlight. And the way I'm I'm lighting up those air molecules at right angles, it becomes a polarizing re-radiator from my point of view.
Yeah, but you didn't answer the question. You have, it just go specific. You have a photon. What is photon heating in within the air particle? What is then that is being heated by that photon doing with that? Name that part.
In the past, I simplistically called it shaking the molecule in that angle of polarization. I called it shake. I know that that's not really happening.
It is what is happening is an electron that is being excited. Photon is hitting an electron within the air molecule. And then this electron, as a mass, is re-radiating the photon back at a different angle. And this is 90 degrees.
The photon is an electromagnetic wave. It has an instantaneous E field and H field to it. The instantaneous E field, when it hits the air molecule, outer radius of electrons around that air molecule, there is an interaction between the E field of the photon hitting the air molecule, there's an interaction between it and the orbit of those electrons around that air molecule. I am guessing the orbit of the electrons around that air molecule become temporarily oriented in the same polarization as the photon's polarization. That is the excitation. And as that electron eventually goes back to its original non-warped path, it re-radiates that photon. That's the excitation and re-radiation. I am guessing, I'm not really shaking the whole molecule. I think I am distorting the orbit of that outer electron shell during the event that that photon hit that air molecule.
That's what I was expecting from you. And then we coming to the relation with double slit experiment and to HHO. The similar effect is happening in three of these instances. The atom is distorted because of either losing or the electron. And then based on the Mendeleev table of chemical substances, that substance is no longer the same substance. So if there is a problem with that, then we're going to double slit experiment in which we're asking, are we dealing with waves as a matter, or are we dealing with the matter that has a mass? Because photon does not have a mass. That's the whole problem that I have in searching for untapped sources of energy.
Who said the photon doesn't have mass?
Professor of physics.
NASA has in the last week and a half established a solar sail, and they're getting thrust out of that solar sail because of the photons hitting it.
I also remember words of Eric and words of Glenn, and they are amazingly smart people. And I remember these discussions where I was ensured that photon does not have a mass. There was you who said, I believe photon does have a small mass, which actually sounds for me very optimistic. I would love if Glenn would say a few words about it.
Let's see if Glenn is still awake. Are you there, Glenn? He's smarter than us. He's getting his beauty sleep. He's got to go to work tomorrow, and so do I. I still believe, and I think we can do a whole lot of internet search on does a photon have mass. And I think there are multiple experiments indicating that there's a small amount of mass. I will admit that spinning thing that we have on our desk from time to time called a radiometer that is not a demonstration of proton mass, because it spins in the wrong direction, if you know what I mean, and that can be explained. But I think there is a very small mass of photons, and I think that mass is the thrust that they're getting out of solar sails. And for the second time, NASA has put up a solar sail, and they are measuring thrust coming out of it. You can argue that it's the solar wind that's creating the thrust, or you can argue that it's the photons creating the thrust, or it's both. And we got to do some more reading on that one. I think the mass of a photon is very small, but I think it's real. The best proof I've got that a photon has mass is that it will experience gravity lensing effects. Only objects with mass will experience gravity lensing. M2XJN, K2RIW.
KEYBAC comment.
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, we're going to lose the repeater anyhow, 1 o'clock, but I just wanted to say quickly, if you read the explanation that Einstein extended after Planck's, if you remember the experiment that Planck did on quantum ideas by demonstrating the radiation consists of, what do you call it, corpuscles that he named photons, he used the photon, how the heck do you use photon concept to explain the photoelectric effect? I'd have to really get the words out of it, because I don't remember that much physics, but I do remember that Einstein and Planck's quantum ideas about photons explains it all, Dick, over.
The problem that I have with it is that, and I would appreciate if you can find a time, these three videos that I have sent you are really, really a piece of information. Now, the problem that I have with it is that if you say that the photon does have a mass, while the strong magnetic field is not able to reflect it at the same time, electron does have a mass, and plasma is very easy to be deflected by the magnetic field. Of course, you say that, you're going to say that I'm confusing magnetism with gravity. Back to you.
When a photon strikes a photodetector, like a photomultiplier tube, it does definitely discharge an electron from that surface. So therefore, that is a piece of evidence, not proof, evidence that the photon has mass. It discharged an electron that then flows through the photodetector, through the vacuum. Also, the photon will be deflected by a magnetic field, by a gravity field, and that's what goes on with gravity lensing. The photon itself, though, is an oscillating electromagnetic field. At this nanosecond it's positive, and the next nanosecond it's negative with my particular method of measurement. As such, it does not have a steady state field. It does not have a charge. It does not have a steady state magnetic field. It does not have a steady state E field. Therefore, a photon, for the most part, is not deflected by a magnetic field, but it is deflected by a gravity field. That's what I think I know. Over to you, Wesley, K2LIW.
Okay, and the atom does have a model, and you can see it. And within that model, you have an electron. What is the model of photon?
It is a bundle of energy. The bundle of energy is an electromagnetic field. It has a very specific wavelength, or you could say it has a very specific frequency. It doesn't have substance in the normal sense. If I want to make an E field, I can do it by having an upper plate, a lower plate, and I put electrons on one plate, I take them out of the other plate. I'm using electrons to create the E field. The photon does not have any electrons. Yet it does have an instantaneous E field that's oscillating at a very fast rate. If it has no real substance, how in the world does it have mass? I know. There I've got a conflict.
Okay, and because we're losing the repeater. see, the old school, military school that I have attended to, was saying that the waves, the longer the wave, the more it bends. Now, if the gravity is affecting the photon, then what you said a few months ago, electromagnetic waves do not bend.
What?
Has to be correct and to exist.
It does bend when it goes to plasma. When it goes to a plasma. A plasma is not...
Not gonna happen. Oh well. Weird number two.